From WNYC, this is The Sporkful. It's not for foodies, it's for eaters. I'm Dan Pashman, and we're coming to you live from Tufts University in Medford, Massachusetts. That was excellent. That's what I call a jumbo welcome. It is great to be here on the campus of Tufts University, my alma mater, where I graduated in 1999. Joining me now is a very talented and original comedian, as well as a former high school classmate of mine. He's a 2010 Last Comic Standing finalist. He's appeared on The Tonight Show with Conan O'Brien, The Late Show with David Letterman, Comedy Central Presents. His latest comedy special is on Netflix. It's called Small, Dork, and Handsome. Please welcome Mike Kaplan.
Thank you, everybody.
Mike, it's great to see you.
It is great to be seen.
You have a master's degree in linguistics.
Yes.
And I know that a lot of your humor is related to language, and I wanted to engage you on a little Sporkful-esque discussion here.
You may.
I am on record as saying that I do not believe that sparkling water is water.
Okay.
I believe that when you add CO2 to it, it ceases to be water.
Is there anything that you can add to water that would make it remain water?
Water is H2O.
What about salt water? Is that water?
It's ocean water, which is a different type of water.
Type of what? I did study linguistics, and we discussed, like, I had a class of semantics where we discussed, like, what is the meaning of a chair? And we talked about, like, what makes something a chair, like, as opposed to, like, say, a stool, because you have a chair that's very similar to a stool. You make it a little higher, oh, it's not a chair anymore. Or wait, it's a high chair. That's a higher chair. And you guys are familiar. And there's a bunch of babies in the audience. So if you say, think of a chair, you would think of, most of us would think of a similar looking thing, sort of the prototypical chair, but you could have a beanbag chair, which we're also like, that's a chair, because it has the function of a chair.
Right.
And so you have the form and the function combined to make the thing. And definitely, the more things that you add to water, the farther away it gets from the prototypical water. But I would say that carbonated water is still it's not so far from water. Like, if you were going to argue that tea isn't water, I'd be like, okay, but also it's like 90-something% water, plus it had some stuff in it.
Then why aren't human beings water?
Fair question.
Thank you.
I mean, basically, there's one version of me that would have to continue to argue that human beings are, because of the percentage of water that we are, we're mostly water. But I do think
so. If I said, yeah, Mike, I want a glass of water, and you hand, and I
get into a cup and hand myself to you.
Right.
I don't see why you could have a problem with that. I'm water, drink me.
That would not quench my thirst.
No, it probably wouldn't. I do think that, I mean, I think that there is a number, like if something's 99% water, then that's water. Is ice water? I mean, ice water is water, but it's water with ice in it, and ice is also water. So, I'm not saying that I'm not going to tell anyone that they're wrong, but I think if your last name is water, like salt water, carbonated water, flavored water, then
What if you're a misnomer? I mean, here's my point, Mike. If you're going to go at it with the approach of we must find a percentage point at which something ceases to be water.
I won't say must, but go on.
Okay, but if that's the path we're going to go down, you're going to have a big gray area, and you're never really going to know. There's always going to be very contentious issues, and these, you know, as you know, you are a lover of language, words matter. If you go with H2O, water is H2O, and if there's anything else in there besides two hydrogens and an oxygen, it has to be something that got there naturally, like a mineral that seeped into the water, you know, like whatever just got there naturally.
So if there was naturally carbonated water, you'd be fine calling that water?
Yes.
And so you have two cups, otherwise indistinguishable, both with carbon in them.
No, the intent of the water must be to be H2O. The water must be striving to be pure H2O.
I don't like to use the word crazy too much, because I don't think that that's, you know, it's not kind to people who have mental illnesses, but you are, I'm going to say being unreasonable. I think it, if there are, water doesn't have intent. I mean, unless you're saying that humans are water, in which case that kind of water does.
So water does have intent.
Wait, but now you're saying that humans are water.
Oh,
so,
damn it.
Yeah. And I didn't, look, this is natural.
Let's move on, shall we?
Fair enough. So, who won?
Let's do an audience poll here. By applause, who here thinks that carbonated water, sparkling water, is water? All right. Yeah, that's enough. Who here thinks that it is not water? All right. Well, I got the rabbi. The rabbi clapped for me, so we'll call it a tie. All right.
And were there any scientists clapping for the first time? Science says yes, religion says no.
What part of becoming vegan has been surprising to you? Like, what did you not expect?
Honestly, that it was so much easier than I expected. Like, vegan, oh my God, to be vegan, you gotta read everything and ask a lot of questions and be so annoying. And then I was like, wait, I'm good at all that. And
is vegan cheese cheese?
I know there's like some debates going on with the issue of like mayo. I feel like
I should fill people in. So there's a company called Hampton Creek that has created a vegan mayo that has no eggs in it. It's called Just Mayo. It has a picture of an egg on the label. And I have gone on record. The FDA is giving them a hard time. The FDA is saying, you can't call that mayo because mayo is eggs and oil. It has to have eggs and oil. And there's a fight going on. And I have said that I think that the FDA is right. I don't think... And I've had the Just Mayo, and it's very delicious. I'm not knocking it.
Oh, yeah. No,
but
I understand.
It's not mayo.
The idea is that are they trying to put one over on people,
right,
to trick people into thinking like, hey, this is mayo and it's good, and then they eat it and you're like, ha-ha, it wasn't. It's actually better for you and the environment and animals. And you're like, damn it, I wanted to hurt things, you know? But here's the thing is, like, so, number one, language changes over time. Like, we're not speaking the same thing that Chaucer wrote in or Shakespeare. For example, milk means many things. Like, you know, there's soy milk, almond milk, rice milk, and we now understand that, like, soy milk isn't a cow product. And I think that, ideally, probably the Just Mayo people would argue it, that their context was, like, it's a product that's like it. It's taking the function of it, so we're giving it the last name. There's things out there. I like cuter names. Like, there's, like, Neo. You know that? There's, like, Neonaise.
Right.
It's like mayonnaise, but it also has, like, the...
You like that better than Veganaise?
Yeah, I like, of the names, I like Neonaise better than Veganaise, because it's cute.
Okay. In Russia, do they have Nietanes?
Do they?
I don't know, but it'd be great if they did.
I mean, that's not as... I'm not sure. I would like a fake lettuce called Nietas. Why are you making lettuce fake? We just, you know, Russia. In Russia, lettuce. Anyway.
Yeah, I'm on the fence on the cheese one. That one I'm willing to cut you a little bit more slack because I feel like there's so many... There's a bazillion different types of cheese already, so I feel like it's easier to throw a couple more on the pile. What are some of the dumbest things people say to you when they hear that you're vegan?
I mean, here's the thing somebody said once. They were like, what if you found out that trees could feel? What would you do then? I was like, well, I guess I would just keep not eating trees. And they're like, wait. I'm like, you only get one wish. You know what I mean? I think that honestly, I think that a lot of people don't realize that I've thought about it a lot more than they have probably. Like, I'm not saying that I'm better than anyone. I'm not saying it, you know. But, I don't know, like, we're all, you know, just a bunch of water. And, but a thing that people will say sometimes is, like, you don't know what you're missing. I'm like, well, for about 20 years, I ate everything that you ate, possibly. And now I've, for almost the next 20 years, been doing what I want. You can't eat everything. You can't date all the people. You can't read all the books. You can't eat all the food. You can't go to all the movies. Like, so if you're just talking about what you're missing, we're all missing billions of things. Like, we're always, you'll be so sad if you just focus on what you don't have. So, and honestly, like, I'll eat some fake meat things, but, like, even, like, vegan technology today, like vegan desserts, and like all these things like have vastly improved since like 10 years ago or 15 years ago when I first became vegan, and I had like a vegan cheesecake, and it was just like a piece of tofu, and they're like, it's shaped like cheesecake. Is that good? You're like, it's a triangle. Do you like eating a triangle? You liked a triangle made out of cheese. But like now, if you go into any like, you know, upscale vegan restaurant, like their desserts, I actually brought some vegan cookies that my girlfriend baked, and I'll let you have one after the show.
I have had many wonderful experiences with vegan desserts in particular. I agree with you. I think that there's been great progress in the field of vegan desserts.
And I'll grant that maybe the maximal experience of eating cannot be attained by me, but also eating is a minimal fraction of everybody's day. Like, you know, it's something we do every day.
Well, all right, slow down there, Mike.
I'm saying just by quantity.
By number of minutes, perhaps,
yes.
but by mental energy devoted to thinking about it and pleasure derived from it, it's most of my life.
I understand.
But let me
suggest another way to be. You have a book and a whole career based around this myth and a lie.
Mike Kaplan performs his wonderful brand of comedy all over the country. Check out his tour dates at mikekaplan.com. That's M-Y-Q. He also hosts a podcast called Hang Out With Me on the Keith and the Girl Network. And you can watch his latest stand-up special on Netflix now. It's called Small, Dork, and Handsome. Ladies and gentlemen, big hand for my friend Mike Kaplan. As we go to break, let's hear a little bit of the Tufts Beelzebubs performing live at our show there. The Bubs are Tufts' oldest all-male a cappella group, and they have a new album out called In the Book. You can stream it for free right now on Spotify. Take a listen. She told me don't worry about it. She told me don't worry. No more. We both know we can't go without it. She told me you'll never be alone. I can't feel my face when I'm with you. But I love it. But I love it. Coming up, more from Tufts. I'll play you clips of some of my less stellar moments as a college radio host, and I'll talk to my college advisor live on stage. We'll discuss what the great philosophers would have said about a timeless snack mix question. If you pick out all the pretzels, is that wrong? Stick around. I can't feel my face when I'm with you. But I love it. But I love it. But I love it. But I love it. I can't feel my face. Welcome back to The Sporkful from WNYC Studios. I'm Dan Pashman. As I said, it was really exciting for me personally to do the show live on stage at Tufts because the first time I was ever on the radio was at Tufts. I came to radio a little late. It wasn't until my senior year. And so my friend Gabe and I were kind of at the bottom of the totem pole. So the only time slot we could get was 2 a.m. to 4 a.m. And our show was called After Hours with G-Money and the Pash Man. I was the Pash Man. And we had a lot of great times, and I like to think that there was some good radio made, but it wasn't all good. Take a listen.
This is 91.5 FM WMFO. Is that a good radio voice? I'm trying to work on my radio voice.
And we will be taking the third caller.
Right, the third caller, unless we get fewer than three callers.
Then we will take the last caller that calls under three.
Well, we had a small little technical difficulty there in our intro. What happened was I forgot to turn the mics on.
Yeah, I noticed.
But, you know, we're still learning.
All right, like, it wasn't pretty, okay? But it was a start. It set me on the path that I've been on for most of the past 18 years. And as you'd expect, I also had some formative food experiences when I was at Tufts. I talked a bit about those at our live show.
I remember a chicken nugget eating contest in the dining hall. I was the champ. I ate 45 chicken nuggets in one sitting. I'm not proud of that. Well, I'm a little bit proud. But I think my two best food memories from Tufts, one was going home late at night from parties, and I get up to the top of the hill in front of Olin Hall, and there on the sidewalk, it's like 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, but it's sitting in the middle of the sidewalk, is a giant pile of cookies. And I was with my friend Mike, and I'm like, Mike, Eureka. And Mike's like, you are not going to eat cookies off of the ground. And I said, no, of course I'm not going to eat cookies off the ground. I'm going to eat cookies off of cookies. So I only ate the cookies that were touching other cookies, and they were delicious. Then there was a time homecoming weekend. There was some big alumni event on Fletcher Field, and I was walking home by there, and the whole thing had been cleaned up, except they left one giant grill. Like, dining services left an industrial size, like, grill on wheels. So I did what any quick-thinking college student did. I wheeled it back to my apartment. And the next morning, I wheeled it to the football field. And we had the biggest tailgate party the Tufts has ever seen. So I want to take a moment to thank dining services. Yeah, give a big hand. Big hand for dining services. I want to thank them for leaving things all over campus, because they really provided some of my most treasured memories. Now, I should say, not all my most treasured memories at Tufts were food-related. I think back to one of the first classes I took, first semester freshman year, took this class called Western Political Thought 1. In a big lecture hall, walked in on the first day, a few minutes before class, sat down, I see this professor at the front of the room. He's got long, shaggy hair. He's scribbling furiously on the board, filling the board up with chicken scratch. The class begins, he cracks open a can of Diet Coke and begins pacing back and forth, gesticulating and shouting about Plato and Aristotle and how they all relate to the movie Pulp Fiction. And I think that most people, you know, you go to college, you think back to one class that really changed the way you think, that opened your eyes to a new way of thinking. And for me, that class was Western Political Thought. And it informs the Sporkful in a lot of ways. These ideas of questioning underlying assumptions, questioning conventional wisdom. These are things we do on the Sporkful to this day. In fact, there's a section in my book all about the ethics of snack mix and cherry picking certain ingredients from a snack mix that's written as a Socratic dialogue. And I had to go get my old Western Political Thought textbooks and review them in order to write that section of my book. So it's with me to this day. And the man who taught that class was Professor Rob Devine, who went on to become my advisor. I took more classes with him. He was a great teacher. And so when I knew I was going to be back at Tufts to do a live Sporkful, I had to get Professor Devine up on stage. You have a snack mix arrayed before you with four or five different components. And let's say one person keeps picking out all the pretzels. What do you see as the argument against that behavior? And what philosopher do you most associate with that argument?
I would say, first of all, that Thomas Hobbes would say that you're going to have a big problem if you're just going to let people pick out of the snack mix without having some type of higher authority that's going to determine at what point will people's safety be harmed. So Hobbes would be primarily making sure that nobody was going to get sick and that none of the food was going bad.
But I mean, wouldn't Hobbes just be like, hey, snack mix is nasty, brutish, and short?
When there's no higher sovereign. That's the reason for the higher sovereign.
Oh.
The higher authority. So, again, he wrote a tremendous book. Okay, I just want to give it a plug.
Hobbes did?
Both of you.
Thank you.
Hobbes and Pashman.
That's going in the back of my next book. I'm sure the copies will fly off the shelves. thank you, anyway.
Sure. Rousseau would say, well, to get into, you know, you used to always, I remember your midterm, and you actually got Hobbes and Rousseau a little mixed up. And you know, so, Rousseau would have a social contract, and he would say, well, we all have to have some type of agreement as to how, what's going to be our general will. So Rousseau would say there would have to be a general agreement between cherry picking or keeping harmony. I'm using your...
Sure.
And if you violated the general will, the general will had the right to force you to be free. So the general will could literally make you spit up.
Or at the very least, prohibit you from eating further snack mix.
It responds more to actions that have been done, but it would originally prohibit you because that's what the general will would say, yeah.
So what would you say is the argument that says cherry picking is okay, and what philosophers do you associate with that argument?
Well, I think you could turn to Nietzsche's argument that God is dead. So by God is dead, meaning all the traditional ways of eating are gone. What used to be breakfast, lunch, or dinner is now up in the air. And it could either lead to great creativity and entirely new foods, or it could be that we will sort of just fade in the context of the task and continue to act the way we did under God, and continue to act in a very passive way, and continue to sort of restrict how we eat.
Because that's the way we're comfortable?
Yes, that's the way we've been trained. So now we do it even though we no longer
know
why we're doing it.
Right. And the argument that I make in the book, or I know Socrates makes it in my book, and he wins because he always wins Socratic dialogues. That's why they're named after him. And the argument that I try to make through him is that when you eat a snack mix, any individual snack mix is a representation of the one true mix, the great snack mix in the sky, which is what I would call the Platonic ideal of snack mix. And whatever that Platonic ideal is for you, your personal great snack mix in the sky. And while you may never get there, it is the quest that defines us all. And I believe that by cherry picking the closest that you can get to your ideal snack mix from the available ingredients, you are imposing your will to power, and you are becoming, you are moving closer to the great snack mix in the sky. And I feel like it is every eater's right. And it's not that you're, like, it's not that one snack mix experience is not a discrete moment in time. It is part and parcel of a lifetime of snack mix consumption. What do you think?
A great lecture. I think it's mainly right what you said. And I think he would side with those who are picking what they want to pick and eating what they want to eat. So I definitely agree with you about that. The only thing I hesitate about is that Socrates said that the self-examined life is the best life. And you never do anything unless you completely know it. So I'm just wondering as to whether Socrates really would have moved into action unless he knew everything about whatever he was picking out of the snack mix.
How could you know without trying it?
Well, that's been a big debate about Socrates. Was he, you know, how much was he trying, or how much was he just trying to let everybody else who was trying know that they were stupid?
Right. So he was a bit of an armchair quarterback.
Socrates is, yes. That's the charge against him. Yes, one of the charges against him.
Okay. And do you cherry pick ingredients from a snack mix? You personally, when you're at a party?
Yeah, I'm a cherry picker. I don't like balance at all.
Well, I want to thank you again, okay. Professor Devine, for being such a great teacher and advisor, and for joining me here today. A big hand for Tufts' own Professor Rob Devine.
Thank you to him. Thank you, Dan. Great job.
Thanks again to Professor Devine. If you want to read the Socratic dialogue that I wrote in which the great philosophers debate snack mix ethics, that excerpt from my book was published on Slate. I'll link to it at sporkful.com. Quick shout out to Sheer Appeal. They are Tufts' only, the only co-ed Jewish a cappella group on the Tufts campus. And they performed at our live show as well, sang beautifully. They have an album out now called Linguistics. It's available for free on Spotify. That's Sheer Appeal, S-H-I-R, which is Hebrew for song. I want to thank everyone at Tufts Hillel for inviting me to the campus. In particular, thank you to Lenny Goldstein, Shayna Burstyn, Stephanie Sanger-Miller, and Rabbi Jeffrey Summit. They made this show possible. And yes, that's the same Rabbi Summit who made this for me for my Tufts radio show 18 years ago.
Hi, this is Rabbi Jeffrey Summit of Tufts University. You're listening to the only two guys who can make crossing the desert with nothing but matzah a good time. After Hours with G-Money and the Pash Man, 91.5 FM, WMFO, Jumbo Radio.
I will never get tired of listening to that. Shout out also to the Tufts Culinary Society and the Tufts Podcast Network, neither of which existed when I was there. But I think it's so cool that they're there now. Back in my day, I was a member of the Monty Python Society and the Sideburn Society. Incidentally, you know how every member of the Sporkful Junior Eater Society is a president? I got that idea from the Sideburn Society, which had the same policy. This show is a production of WNYC Studios and The Sporkful. It's produced by Ann Sani and me. We got engineering help from Irene Trudell and Bay State Sound. Music help today from Black Label Music. Thanks to Ali Wehner, Cooper McKim, Sarah Gardner, Mark Sullivan, Jordan Rosenthal, Kay, Grant Fox, Eric Poppleton, and everyone at Tufts. Thank you also to Joanna Solitaroff and Paula Schumann. Until next time, I'm Dan Pashman.
And this is Ellen Brady from Peninsula, Ohio, reminding you to eat more, eat better, and eat more better.